Hamas cooperated. It cooperated. That's a fact. And what did they get out of the cooperation? They got reports which were never acted on.
Try to give us a sense of, because I mean, there is, I think a lot of our viewers would know that, because a lot of our viewers, obviously, we cover Palestine extensively, and so a lot of them would be aware. But just give us a sense of how Israel sort of changed, played the victim card, and has worked so hard to kind of push the Palestinians into this point where October 7th happened. Because obviously it's been a long journey for Palestinians and Palestinian resistance, and I think there's often an impression that, you know, the resistance is just a bit mindless. And I'm sure the resistance is flawed because they operate in a very difficult environment, but just kind of, like, you know, speak to that.
Well, you put a severe limitation on me. You said be brief.
Okay, be a bit brief, not too brief.
That's like a death sentence.
This is the quickest way to pee out fat.
Good God, man. Stop eating those. You're going to blow up.
No, I'm not. The numbers on the scale just keep going down, bro.
What? How are you losing weight?
I've been trying this new drink every morning. It's totally natural, and yeah, it's just falling off.
Where does one begin? I think the best place to begin, people can disagree, obviously. I think the best place to begin is 1948. And 1948 represents the climax of a project that began at the end of the 19th century. The climax is the formation of the State of Israel. In the course of Israel's formation, about 90% of the population of what became Israel is expelled. It's about, the rough estimates are about 750,000 Palestinians are expelled. Of those 750,000, approximately 270,000, 300,000 end up in Gaza. And so that's the first fact that we have to always bear in mind, that Gaza is overwhelmingly a refugee population, refugees and their descendants, who under international law, the descendants are also classified as refugees. Gaza is also overwhelmingly a child population. It's about 48% children. Now, again, I'm often accused, I believe incorrectly, of being extreme in my language or of being exaggerating in my language. So I will refer to what others have said. One of the striking things when you go back to the beginning of the creation of Gaza as we know it is that one outside observer after another, one after another, they routinely refer to Gaza as a concentration camp. Now, that's not me. And it's not as if memories of World War II have been obscured. We're talking about right after 1948. So you talk about the chief, a UN representative in Gaza. His name is ELM Burns. And he writes a memoir. And he says, well, there's not starvation. That's in the streets. You don't see starvation in the streets. But he said, Gaza's a huge concentration camp on the sand. That's what it is. By the way, Israelis in all sectors of Israeli life refer to Gaza under Egyptian administration. We're talking about between 1950 and 1967, when it's under Egyptian administration. Burns calls it a concentration camp. The Israelis keep referring to it as a concentration camp. Then in 1967, in July, the father of Al Gore, people will remember as the American who ran for president in 2000, his father was also a senator. He goes to Gaza. He comes back, reports, now it's under Israeli rule, it's after 67. He comes back, he reports to Congress, and he refers to Gaza as a concentration camp. Then, in 2002, a senior Israeli sociologist, Baruch Kimmerling, he writes a book on the occupation when Ariel Sharon was the prime minister. He describes Gaza as, quote, the biggest concentration camp ever. In 2004, the then head of the National Security Council, Gira Island, who's still around, he's playing a most nefarious role the past 15 months during the Israeli genocide in Gaza. How did he describe Gaza? Quote, the head of the Israeli National Security Council describes it as, quote, a huge concentration camp. That was Gaza. Now, in 2006, Hamas wins the parliamentary elections. The parliamentary elections, incidentally, which President Bush demanded, it was the era of what was called democracy promotion after the Israeli-U.S. attack on Iraq. And they demand elections. Hamas doesn't want to participate because it says this is part of the Oslo process, what began in 1993. We won't have anything to do with Oslo process. We don't want to have anything to do with these elections. It's all a facade for Israeli control. Well, they're finally persuaded to participate in the elections. And lo and behold, elections, according to Jimmy Carter, the American president who just passed away, he described the elections as completely honest and fair. And lo and behold, Hamas wins. Immediately as it wins, elections which the U.S. government demanded, immediately as Hamas wins, Israel imposes this brutal economic blockade on Gaza. And then Israel is followed by the United States and the EU, the European Union. And now at this point, Hamas engages because it's an elected government. And it was elected on the hopes, it ran on what was called a reform platform. And it had to deliver on its platform. Otherwise, it's going to be voted out. And so the first order of business has to be to end this blockade, which everybody agrees is destroying Gaza. And it tried many things. First of all, it tried diplomacy. It was sending signals which were acknowledged by U.S. government agencies. It was sending signals that was prepared to end, to terminate the conflict on the basis of international law, namely two states along the June 1967 border. Now, I will admit, no point in, I have a credo in life, never quarrel with facts. I'm not going to dispute. There were gray areas in Hamas's response. Hamas was formally committed to the exercise of the full right of return of the refugees. Now, under international law, they have a very strong case. They have a very strong case under international law that refugees have a right of return. But as a practical matter, I don't believe it's realistic. I don't want to get into this. I'm just saying I will acknowledge that the Hamas response was not perfect, but it certainly was serious. And they had a real dilemma. You have to remember, 70% of Gaza is refugees. So they couldn't very easily give up that right of return. That's their constituency. But all of their attempts to resolve the conflict diplomatically were ignored. They were simply ignored. Then they tried international law. Here is a little known fact. As I mentioned earlier, there were these commissions of inquiry after each of Israel's horrors in Gaza. Now, The commissions of inquiry were not soft on Hamas. Not at all. They accused Hamas of war crimes, of serious war crimes. Okay? Hamas cooperated with the commissions of inquiry. It knew that the final reports of these commissions of inquiry would come to a very harsh judgment on Hamas, indeed accusing them of war crimes. That didn't deter them, because they believed that maybe, even as they're accused of war crimes, they would get some justice, because Israel also would be held to account, which is what Richard Goldstone did and the others did. What came of it? All these reports, and they were put in the desk drawer to collect dust. They tried. Remember, Israel refused to cooperate with any of the commissions of inquiry. Refused up until today. You know, the Navi Pillay Commission of Inquiry, they say no, they're not going to cooperate. Richard Goldstone, they say no, we're not going to cooperate. Mary McGowan Davis after Operation Protective Edge, no, we won't cooperate. Hamas cooperated. It cooperated. That's a fact. And what did they get out of the cooperation? They got reports which were never acted on. They just collected dust. And then they tried nonviolent civil resistance in March 2018, the Great March of Return. They tried nonviolent civil resistance. What came of that? We know exactly what came of it. There was a 250-page Commission of Inquiry report. And you know what the inquiry found? It quoted Israel as saying that they lined up their best snipers along the perimeter fence with Gaza. The Israelis said every bullet fired hit its mark. That's what they said. Every bullet fired by these top snipers hit their mark. Who did they target? The UN 250-page single-space report said they targeted children, journalists, medics, disabled people, double amputees who were 100 to 300 meters away from the perimeter fence and engaging in strictly civilian activities. When they didn't kill the nonviolent demonstrators, they targeted their kneecap and below in order to inflict life-changing injuries. So, the documentary record shows they tried diplomacy, they tried law, they tried nonviolent civil resistance. And on the night of October 6th, Gaza had vanished from the news. I know, because I abandoned Gaza. I gave up after chronicling it in minute detail for more than a decade. I reached the conclusion this is pointless, it's worthless, it's hopeless. Time to move on. I wasn't proud of that decision. There was an element of shame in that decision, but I made it. And it looked as if the Abraham Accords would extend to Saudi Arabia and the people of Gaza would be left to die in that concentration camp. The young men who burst the gates of Gaza on October 7th. They were all around 20. They were born into they languished in and they die. They were destined, they were fated to die in that concentration camp with the only break in the monotony of getting up each morning and pacing the perimeter of Gaza, because 60% of them were unemployed, the young men. 60% were unemployed. The only break in the monotony of their existence was the periodic high-tech killing sprees, Israel's mowings of the lawn in Gaza. And they were born into, they languished in, and as of October 6th, they had been abandoned by the whole of humanity without exception, and they were destined to die there. Those who want to criticize them, in my opinion, they have to first show me what option did they have that they didn't exploit.